Hello, friends. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason, and really glad you joined me today because this first hour, at least the bulk of it, I am going to be spending talking to a mover and shaker in the intelligent design movement. His name is Michael Behe, and you might know that name associated with Darwin's Black Box or The Edge of Evolution, which are his previous two books. And we want to talk about his new book today. It's called Darwin Devolves, The New Science About DNA That Challenges Evolution. Michael, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm looking forward to chatting with you.
Sure, yeah, me too. It should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, we had a nice conversation about 3 weeks ago where we did a kind of special thing online for a group of people. We went over this material, and I really enjoyed that. So I'm looking forward to this time. You know, I mentioned your earlier work and, of course, your involvement with the you're not only professor of biochemistry at Lehigh University, you're also a founding senior fellow of the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. And of course, founding, that means you've been involved like 25 or 30 years with those guys, right?
Yeah, time flies.
Yeah, well, you've been doing fabulous work. And I just want to say, and maybe you can explain briefly the concept for those who are unfamiliar with it. I think that the notion of irreducible complexity that you at least formally introduced in your first book, Darwin's Black Box, has been one of the most helpful, useful, powerful, compelling, persuasive tools for me making a case against the Darwinian project writ large. So maybe you could tell us just a moment about that concept of irreducible complexity, just so people can kind of get that in their toolbox.
Sure. Okay. Irreducible complexity is a fancy phrase, but it just means something simple. It means you've got some machine or system or something that does something interesting, and it needs a number of parts in order to work. And if you take away one of the parts, it can't function anymore. So it's complex because it's got a number of parts, but it's irreducible because you can't take any away.
Mm-hmm.
A good illustration from our everyday life is a mouse trap, a mechanical mouse trap. You take away a spring or you take away one of parts of a standard mouse trap, it doesn't work anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And the relevance of this to evolution is twofold. Many of the molecular machines that have been discovered at the cellular level of life are irreducibly complex, like that mouse trap.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing is that Darwin's theory of evolution has to work by slow and gradual changes, building things up step by step, improving them along the way.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, there's nothing to select, and Darwin's mechanism fails. But it's real hard, maybe possible, to build something that's irreducibly complex step by step. You can't, how can you build a mouse trap, tiny step by tiny step,
right.
Improving it.
Yeah, it isn't like you make a block of wood and that's going to catch a few mice, and then if you add a spring to it, it catches a few more, and if you add a tripwire or whatever, that's the problem, isn't it, with biological mechanisms?
Absolutely. So most people think of them as kind of just jelly or some gooey stuff, like when you run over a groundhog on the road or something.
Well,
but it turns out they're machines. There's machines in them. Things.
Even that groundhog is a whole bunch of machines, but it's kind of broken and messed up, after you run over it, And I think this is one of the things that has been so helpful to me, because as I've looked at and tried to make the case in more popular field, against the Darwinian model, the standard Darwinian model, which you just described, step by step, small improvements, and each individual step help move that organism towards more viability, and therefore it's going to reproduce more, and that's how the evolutionary project works forward. When people realize that even the smallest cell is made up of a gazillion very complicated machines. I mean, I've seen the kind of video graphic or the, what do you call them, like the cartoon representations of them. It's amazing. It's amazing. It's like a factory going on inside of that one cell.
Yeah, that's it's like a completely automated factory that makes, you know, automobiles or computers or some such thing. It's probably even much more complicated than that because it has to reproduce itself and
right.
all sorts of things. And it's interesting that back in his day, Darwin, you know, knew nothing about the cell or very, very little, just because nobody then had figured anything out. The cell was thought to be protoplasm, just as we said, some jelly.
Mm-hmm.
And under the microscopes of the time, they were pretty crude, so they didn't look like much of a much. It had a dark spot in it. You know, what was that? It
yeah.
turned out to be the nucleus.
And, that little simple thing, right?
Yeah, whatever, you know. So it was real easy to imagine that, well, maybe this jelly would just kind of glop together on the sea bottom or something and then kind of shape itself into various shapes.
Mm-hmm.
And there you have it.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things many years ago, and we didn't meet at this time, but I think it was the very first time I saw you in public in Mequon, Wisconsin at the special
yeah.
event. It was kind of an insider's uh-huh. event that I was able to sneak into called Design and Its Critics. You guys in the intelligent design community, largely the Discovery Institute folk, invited a whole bunch of very high-level scientific critics of the intelligent design product to have dialogue together. And I remember it was like peer-reviewed in a certain sense. It would be the ID person speaking about his particular area, and then someone from the other side giving kind of a counter talk, and then you guys would interact with Q&A. And I think you were opposite the gentleman from Brown University.
Ken Miller.
Ken uh-huh. Miller, uh-huh. yeah, that's right. And he was, I'll tell you something about that I remember about that conversation that for me was quite telling regarding the critique of your observations of irreducible complexity and the problem this created for Darwinism. And maybe you can comment on it. What he did was he said, well, if things are irreducibly complex, that means you can't reduce them and have them work, which, of course, as far as you go, that's right. But then he gave an example of a automobile that has four wheels and a motorcycle that has two wheels. So obviously you can go from four wheels to two wheels and it would still work. And inside, I'm not even very clever, but I'm laughing inside like you're doing now because it misses the entire point. It's not that you can't have a vehicle with two wheels versus four wheels, but if you took the four-wheeled vehicle and took two of the wheels off of that vehicle, it wouldn't work.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And a number of things is these folks, I don't know if they truly don't get it or just don't want to engage or what. But, yeah, I think Ken Miller was just trying to be clever and refute a logical point, saying that, well, you know, if you can only have cars with four wheels, then you can't have vehicles with two. But yeah,
but that wasn't your point, though. Your point was any given complex mechanism that works together that's irreducibly complex means that you can't take any part of that one away.
Right.
Not that there couldn't be simpler mechanisms that
right.
could also themselves do something similar.
Sure. Yeah. Even with a mousetrap, you know, you can make mousetraps in many, many different ways.
Right.
But the one that, you know, the one that you get in the hardware store, you know, you can't build that gradually or even starting from another mousetrap. You can't do it by numerous successive slight and random mutations.
That's right.
Changes.
And that would be that's the citation there from Darwin there and identifying the problem of irreducible complexity. By the way, I have built a mousetrap, a rat trap in my house. It's a walk the plank trap. So it's over. It's like a plank with a bait on the end, and when they get to the end, it gives way and drops them in a bucket. So there you go. So that's even simpler than all the spring business. But but that itself is irreducibly complex. You take away the plank, it's not going to work. You take away the bucket, it's not going to work. Take away the magnets that make it work, it's not going to, you know. So anyway, so this has been a great, I think, a great contribution to the field, this concept of irreducible complexity, because it's easy to grasp, first of all, and from your illustration. And then when you go ahead and you see the multitude, and that's an understatement, the multitude of highly complex, and that's another understatement. We're not talking about mousetraps here. We're talking about very sophisticated machinery that is even in the simplest cell. It just seems to me like an overwhelming task for Darwinian evolutionists appealing simply to time and chance to explain these kinds of things. So what is the deal? I don't understand. I mean, I do, but I want you to explain it for our listeners a little bit. The amount of the intensity of the resistance to a common sense concern that you are presenting with something like irreducible complexity.
Sure. Yeah. None of this is hard to see. I appreciate compliments and stuff, but this is pretty straightforward if you aren't beholden to Darwin's theory and if you see the stuff that's in the cell. People do not try to account for these things. Nobel Prize winners, nobody tries to account for them. They take for granted that Darwin's mechanism produced life, and then they just look at little tangential questions like, what resembles what more closely than it resembles something else, and so on. But they never try to actually explain how that mechanism could build these things. And it's clearly a philosophical / theological objection or reason. Mm-hmm. They just don't. Many scientists don't want there to be a designer. They don't want to be something outside of nature that affected it. And other people, have other odd reasons. They want biology to be kind of an independent science, like chemistry and physics. They don't want to have to think about something outside of just the material they study. And of course, there's been a history between science and religion ever since, Darwin's book first came out.
Right.
So for a bunch of complicated reasons, but the effect is astounding, as you see, is that grown men, smart guys, look at these things and, you point these things out and they have nothing to say. They have nothing, on point to say. They'll try to divert the argument, but they will refuse to see something that any child could see.
Yeah, I just remember thinking when I heard Ken Miller's response, how to your discussion there in Wisconsin that one year at that event, how weak it was. And I thought to myself, is this the best that you could? It was obviously a misguided challenge to your point of view. Is this the best that you can possibly do, And even, you mentioned how they want to keep biology kind of separate, like chemistry and physics. But see, even when you do your work, the reason that you have peer review on the work is because sometimes there is evidence or there is an indication that the evidence has been tampered with in a way that brings you to false conclusions, right?
Sure.
So if it's tampered with by a human agent, that means even in those disciplines, you are able to recognize agent tampering, right?
Yeah, sure.
Is the very issue here.
That's correct. Yeah, people will say that, but then they'll say, "Yeah, but that's human tampering, and you can't say, you can't go beyond. We know humans are a part of nature, and you can't go beyond that, and it's illegal. You're not allowed to think that way."
That's right. That's kind of you're off the reservation when you start doing that. But just to make our case a bit, a human is an agent, and we are capable of recognizing agent tampering, so to speak, agency, and when the nature of the thing indicates agent tampering, and it's not possible that a human could have done that, like the DNA code, for example, then we ought to infer some non-human agent. It seems perfectly reasonable, but of course, I'm preaching to the choir right now.
I'm not gonna contradict you there.
Yeah, you mentioned in the past about people like Neil deGrasse Tyson and other scientists suggesting that maybe we're part of a big computer, like a Matrix thing, and I don't know if they really take that seriously, but if they do, it's kind of surprising to me that, and I know some people believe in directed panspermia, you know, that aliens planted life here on Earth, and they go for that, as unlikely as that seems, but they won't go for God, who right. is much better evidenced in the project, it seems.
Yeah, that's right. It confuses me too. I guess they just don't want anybody who's around who's going to tell them what to do.
that's
the problem.
I can sympathize with the sentiment, right? Nobody wants us to have somebody else telling us what to do. However, that doesn't change the reality of the fact. Now, you mentioned something a moment ago. We've been talking a little bit about your project with Darwin's Black Box and the foundational contribution that made to the whole discussion. Your new book is called Darwin Devolves, the new science about DNA that challenges evolution. And that's just been out for a month or so. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. End of February it came out. So it's shaking a few things up now. It's already gotten some responses. And yeah, I think this really pushes the conversation along quite a bit because Darwin's Black Box said it showed what Darwin's mechanism couldn't do. You know, it can't build these irreducibly complex things.
Uh-huh.
There's a bunch of them around, but this book shows what Darwin's mechanism does do.
Actually does, right.
Yeah, and it's a surprising result, and it's much different from what it was touted to do.
Well, the book is called Darwin Devolves. It's available at darwindevolves.com, just for people to know, and also on Amazon, of course, in the standard outlets. Now, something that you said early on in the book that really caught my attention, and it lays a predicate, I think, for what that follows, is something you refer to as the pretense of knowledge. The pretense of knowledge. You actually made a little side reference to the notion a few moments ago. And to me, this is a real important part of the larger project. Actually, I just thought of something. Before we get to that, let me ask about, because that notion depends on a distinction between microevolution and macroevolution. So can you distinguish between microevolution and macroevolution for our listeners and how one allegedly relates to the other?
Sure. Microevolution traditionally has been understood as evolution within a species or maybe between sister species or something. So if you have a bird that has two different, you know, splashes of color or something, well, okay. And maybe there's a species that's very, very, very similar and it has a different splash of color. Well, that's fine. That's microevolution. At the species level or the right around species.
Like the finchbeaks, for example, the famous Galapagos finches.
Exactly. The Galapagos finches have different sized beaks, and they're smaller or larger birds themselves, and they're categorized into 14 different species. But they're all finches. They're all pretty similar to each other.
Mm-hmm.
But macroevolution is, of course, the big stuff, which everybody's interested in, and how do you get different classes of organisms, like birds versus fish, or even you know, hippopotamuses versus giraffes, and things like that. So it's the at the organism level, micro is as its name implies, just little changes in pre-existing organisms.
Mm-hmm.
And macro is how in the world do these big changes come about through random changes and natural selection.
Mm-hmm. So, in other words, how did you get finches in the first place? Not how did you get larger finch beaks or smaller
right.
finch beaks or larger finches or smaller finches.
Right. Even given some generic bird, you know, how do you get a finch from that? Say a generic bird like a crow or mm-hmm. An ostrich, or how mm-hmm. do you get those from some ancestor? And how does it give rise to finches as well as these other, you know, really different categories of birds. And that's utterly unknown. And that's, again, it's just taken for granted that they all came about from some ancestor by Darwin's mechanism. But nobody ever even tries to show how.
So what's going on here, though, is kind of an extrapolation. We look at a very simple level, and we see these small, modest kind of changes that might be attributed to, say, a genetic mutation. And these changes then create a different kind of morphology, something in the body that is an adaptation that allows that creature to reproduce more frequently in the future, as long as the environmental conditions stay the same. And so then, we see that, and then macro is the jump that says, and that kind of thing is unlimited in its capability.
That's right, exactly. We can reliably extrapolate from tiny changes to everything in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So if we see a cow step over a stream, then we can extrapolate and say the cow can jump over the moon.
Yeah.
So that's the scale of it.
Yeah. That's probably an understatement when you consider the incredible complexity of the biological system. So now you and I talked about this before, and you made a brief reference to species. And just to be clear for the audience, these kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species distinctions are completely man-made.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah. That's right. We make classification systems. Nature just is, and we're trying to sort things out as best we can.
Make it easier for us. Right. But what you said to me in our last conversation is they're at the in a certain sense, the lower levels, the more specific areas, levels like species, there can be lots of variation there. But when you start moving up the ladder, so to speak, there's a breakout point, roughly, I think you explained at the class level, where you're not going to see the variation. And what I mean by is that the empirical data has demonstrated changes within smaller levels, the lower levels, but not these bigger macro jumps into the higher levels. That's a complete extrapolation from the what activity is that's observed on these lower levels. Is that correct?
Yeah, sure. That's right. I mean, when you're going up to the level of differentiating, you know, a mammal from a bird, from a fish, and so on, then, you know, you can list characteristics that all mammals have, that all birds have, and that all birds have, and no mammals have, and so on. So there is not the variation there that you get at the very tips of the branches of biology.
Yeah. Right. Okay, so this brings me to another really important point. I want to cover this before we take a break. And that is what I referred to a few moments ago as the pretense of knowledge. And that is the jump from what we can demonstrate on a micro level empirically to an assumption of what actually took place on a macro level that is not demonstrated empirically. And you give some examples in the chapter on pretense of knowledge, and you call it red flag number one.
Yeah.
And then you give a couple of citations of these kind of sweeping comments about things that evolved. And I wonder if you could develop that point a little bit for us here, because I think this is a very, very important point as we assess the evidence for Darwinian macroevolution.
Yeah, well, pretense of knowledge is just a fancy way of saying, you know, people bloviate beyond their knowledge and, and abilities. And, you know, we're all human. We all tend to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I give an example in the first chapter of economists back, you know, when there was raging inflation in the United States, and they would give their prescriptions of what to do, but nobody knew how to address the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And economists, economics is famously, you know, fuzzy at just predicting the economy, you know, a year away, let alone decades away.
It's like the weather.
Exactly. Yeah, the weather, same thing. You can't predict the weather much more than a week away, at least in Pennsylvania you can't.
And the way you explain that in your book is that weather and economics and biological development are really, really complex things that are influenced by a large number of different factors, and not like physics, which in a certain sense is kind of simple and straightforward. All of these other things are so complex it's hard to figure out how all the parts fit together to move something forward, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, it's no, you know, slur against evolution or biology or anything like that, but they suffer from the same limitations that other fields that study complex topics do, like economics and like long-term, say, weather forecasting.
Mm-hmm.
You simply can't know what's going to happen, you know, a month out in weather. You can't know what's going to happen a year out in economics.
Mm-hmm.
And to say in biology that you know that, say, that dinosaurs gave rise to birds by random mutation and natural selection is simply ludicrous. You know, you can see, you know, you can study the fossil record and get an idea of what happened when, maybe, you know, what creatures lived at what time.
Mm-hmm.
But to say you know how that happened is, like I say, a pretense of knowledge.
Yeah. Well, the illustration you give in the book is a citation from Scientific America. And here it is, a single sentence. Humans have evolved a sense of self that is unparalleled in its complexity.
Yeah.
What's wrong with that sentence?
Well, the word, now, suppose you repeat the sentence without the word evolved. Humans have a sense of self that is unrivaled in, you know, in nature.
In complexity,
you know,
right.
In complexity, yeah. What information have you lost? What work did the word evolve do? You know, there have been no studies of, say, neurons and how, you know, a sense of self arises. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, people don't even know what a sense of self is or what it means to have one or to have a mind.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you know, writers, popular writers, and pretty much any time the topic of evolution comes up on TV shows, they will say, oh, you know, humans evolved to do this, or, you know, this creature evolved to have this bushy tail.
Mm-hmm.
And yet none of this has, there's no experimental or theoretical, well, there's no experimental justification for any of it. But yet when you repeat this enough, it kind of lulls people to sleep. You think that somebody knows how this happened.
Right.
But in reality, nobody does.
Well, I think that's why the title of this chapter, The Pretense of Knowledge, is so appropriate, because it's pretend knowledge. And this, I think, it's trading, and correct me if I'm mistaken here, but it trades on the presumption that micro can go to macro with no problem. So if you show micro, then of course, whatever macro we see, like a sense of self, well, this must have evolved in the same way that the finch beak evolved in the micro. And so there is just this presumption that all of these things must have evolved. And there seems to be no requirement for them to show the process genetically of evolution that resulted in a complicated sense of self. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, you know, essentially it is, you know, you know, we see some complex system. That's the premise. And the second premise is that everything evolved by Darwin's mechanism. And so that complex system evolved by Darwin's mechanism. That's the reasoning there. But the problem is that that masks, you know, enormous problems. You know, on occasion, biologists would point it out along the way and they'd get drowned out. But you are teaching pretty much at generations of school students and the public that we've got everything in hand. Hey, nothing to see here. There, you know, no problems. When in fact, there are lots of problems.
Yeah. Ever since I read in Darwin Devolves, your new book, this area on pretense of knowledge, which is towards the beginning, I have been alert. I'm aware of this problem, but you put it so well and made it so clear in your book. I've been alert to these things, and I have in my hand right now, May 2019. I just got it a couple days ago. We're not even in May yet, although. When this airs, we probably will be. In any event, it's Consumer Reports on Health, okay? And this is the truth about sweeteners. Okay, check this sentence out. Cravings explained. Our first food, breast milk or formula, is sweet, and humans have evolved to equate sweet tastes with safety.
Oh, dear.
There you go.
Yeah, that's the same thing. Just whenever you get a sentence like that, just leave out the word evolved, and it'll make pretty much the same sense, you know. And humans, you know, equate
sweet taste with safety.
With safety, yeah. You know, what work did the word evolved do other than to, you know, create a vague impression in your mind, a science-y kind of impression in your mind?
Well, in their mind, it must have evolved because that's how everything develops. So they just assume it evolved, and they don't feel any obligation to show the pathway of evolution that would justify such a comment. By the way, here's the sentence that follows. Our early ancestors, sweet flavor, for our early ancestors, sweet flavor indicated that a food was okay to eat. Bitter foods were more likely to be harmful. Oh, in other words, this is a learned response of culture. This isn't something that evolved. Do you see the conflict?
Yeah, right. Yeah, this is not some, you know, mutation in DNA. This is saying, hey, Charlie, you know, you can eat this. This tastes pretty sweet.
Yeah, but there's no, they don't blush. There's no sense of the conflict there, and there's no sense of the pretend knowledge that they're promoting. Well, my guest right now, Dr. Michael Behe, Darwin's Black Box, The Edge of Evolution, famously, and now Darwin Devolves, the new science about DNA that challenges evolution. When we come back after break, we will we'll talk specifically about this new development, devolution, and how it affects the entire Darwinian project. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
The Christian worldview is under attack. Its claims about truth, Jesus, morality, and the Bible are all being challenged by some of the toughest critics in the world. That's why I'm thrilled to tell you about Stand to Reason's Rethink Apologetics Student Conference. The Rethink Conference prepares middle school through college-age students to respond with confidence to their teachers, professors, and peers who seek to belittle their Christian beliefs. Join thousands of other leaders, parents, and students as some of the top Christian apologists spend an energizing weekend responding to the hardest questions Christians face. Visit RethinkApologetics.com to learn more and register today.
What does a silo of soybeans or an old 1987 Nissan truck have to do with apologetics? When donated, both enabled STR to provide Christians like you with the resources you need to gain confidence in defending your faith. STR's partnership with iDonate makes donating non-cash items easy. You can give personal items like vehicles, stock, jewelry, gift cards, and more. iDonate takes care of selling the items and gives the cash proceeds to STR. So if you're looking for a unique way to support the work of Stand to Reason, consider donating that random gift card Aunt Bertha gave you last Christmas. Simply go to str.org/donate and click the link at the bottom of the page.
Greg Kokel here with you today. My guest is Michael Behe, author of Darwin's Black Box and The Edge of Evolution. And now Darwin Devolves, the new science about DNA that challenges evolution. And it's available, of course, at Amazon and other outlets. But you might want to just go to Darwin Devolves. That would be Darwell, DEVOLVES.com. And you'll find more information there as well. And I like in your book, what you do is for people who have not maybe been completely up to speed, Michael, on this, the whole project, you lay out a foundation for them and to understand just kind of where you're going here. And then you get more into the specifics of the concept of devolution. Before I hit that, by the way, there is a question, though, and I know that ID theorists have different points of view on this, generally more on one side than the other, but you seem to be unique in that, at this point at least, you don't take exception with common dissent. Can you explain what the concept is there and then why you're not troubled by that itself, if I am understanding
sure.
your view correctly?
Sure, yeah, that's right. Evolution is a fuzzy word, and different people mean different things by it. It turns out that people before Darwin talked about evolution in the sense of creatures giving rise to other different kinds of creatures and so on. But it was always a teleological or purpose-driven process. Either God was guiding these developments or there was some built-in law of nature that guided them.
Mm-hmm.
Darwin's claim to fame was that he thought he came up with a mindless, completely random process that would produce creatures.
Mm-hmm.
To me, the idea of common sense is, you know, it's interesting, but it's trivial. It just says, you know, there were organisms in the past with different features, and there are organisms now, and they have these similar features.
Mm-hmm.
So one probably gave rise to the other. But by itself, it doesn't say how the ancestors got there.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't say how they gave rise to any new types of creatures. It's an interesting point about natural history, but it doesn't say anything philosophically or theologically or pretty much even scientifically all that exciting.
So in other words, to say that there may be an ancestral relationship of living things doesn't tell you how that ancestral relationship was accomplished. And what Darwin wants to argue is that it was non-teleological. That is, there is no purpose in it. It's only chance and natural factors and natural forces, natural selection working on mutations, for example, that created, so to speak, the novelty that then nature could choose, and this is the nature of the relationship of descent with modification. And what you're suggesting is, even if there is some kind of relationship, the science hasn't demonstrated that that's what accounts for it.
That's right. And to me, the 99% of the importance of Darwin's claim is this idea that all of these fantastically complex and functional systems, you know, eyes and hearts and hands and so on,
mm-hmm.
could have arisen solely by an undirected, unintelligent process.
Mm-hmm.
That contains all of the philosophical impact, pretty much the scientific impact too, certainly theological as well. So, you know, frankly, I don't care so much about common descent. You know,
mm-hmm.
you should see some of my relatives. I'd be happy to be, you know, related to some more dignified primates.
Hmm.
But I concentrate on the question of, can unintelligent processes build complex functional things,
mm-hmm.
or is intelligence required? And it's been my experience that Darwinists will be happy to talk with you all day long about common descent, but they kind of run away like vampires from a piece of garlic if you try to ask them, you know, how does your mechanism explain a mousetrap, let alone an eyeball?
Right, right. So the devil's in the details is what it really amounts to, and I want to emphasize that because it's easy for those promoting Darwinism to talk in these very, very general terms and tell their just-so stories and whatever that sound persuasive. But when you get down to the nuts and bolts and say, wait a minute, these big things are all a result of a whole bunch of little things that happen on a cellular level. And that's where the action is, so to speak. And I think this brings us to the main thrust of Darwin Devolves, the new science about DNA that challenges evolution. And it seems like a pivotal point of your initial work is that Darwin's mechanisms are not capable of building those complex structures. But Darwin Devolves takes it a step further. And you argue that the natural processes actually degrade complex structures for individual survival. In other words, they do it to survive, but it's degrading in a way that actually impedes evolution. That's devolution, in other words. So did I get that right?
Yeah, that's it. That's exactly right. And many people get confused when they first hear about this because they say, how can you degrade something or break something and have it improve? Improve a system. And one analogy I like to use is of your, say, a car. Suppose your life depended on your car getting a little bit better gas mileage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what could you do to quickly improve it, improve that gas mileage? Well, you can, of course, take off the doors and throw them away. You can take out the back seat or the hood or something.
Throw the spare away.
Exactly. And, you know, those things are useful at certain times, but if your life depends on getting better gas mileage right now, then that's the smart move to make.
Yeah.
So it turns out that throwing things away and breaking things actually can oftentimes improve your situation. And the new thing that the book emphasizes is that's exactly what we've discovered now in the past 10 to 20 years in the cell, in the evolution of, well, cells and organisms, too.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that right now it's like in astronomy where, you know, 10 or 20 years ago somebody invented a telescope. Before then, speculations about what the universe looked like were, you know, might have been interesting, but they're superseded by what we now see through the telescope.
Right.
In the same way, science has just in the past couple decades developed the ability to probe down to the molecular level and sequence DNA at a very, very easily and in the required detail.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out mutations are changes in DNA. They're changes in molecules.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't determine what those changes were, then you don't know how evolution is happening, even if an organism seemingly improves. And it turns out that many of the changes that people classically have pointed to as examples of the great power of Darwinian evolution, now we know that they are great examples of Darwinian evolution, but they show broken genes, and broken genes that have beneficial effects.
So on one hand, when we were talking about pretense of knowledge a few moments ago, since microevolution has convinced a lot of people that the whole game is accomplished by natural selection working on mutations, they see it on a smaller level, then they just kind of wave the wand over these bigger changes. But now when we, without, as you just pointed out, feeling any responsibility to show specifically on a micro level how this took place, because they knew it did, so it must have. But now that we have the technique and the technology to get down really tight to the molecules, now we see that this is a difficulty and it doesn't work the way they thought it did to accomplish the end that they have in mind.
That's exactly right. It's shown in a number of places, but let me just give you one example because I think it's the coolest one. And I opened the first chapter with it, and that's the example of the polar bear. Now, polar bears are the biggest, baddest land predators in the world, and they're thought to be descended from grizzly bears, brown bears, and they're pointed to as swell examples of Darwinian evolution. They went north, became lighter in color to match the snow, and they could eat seal blubber that grizzly bears can't.
By the way, and just notice how you put that, and they became lighter in color. See,
yeah.
This is one of those just throwaway phrases that they only get lighter in color because there's a genetic change. That has to be accounted for. But I understand you're just telling the story. Go ahead.
Yeah, they evolved a lighter color.
Yes, right.
And, well, it turns out that the whole polar bear genome was sequenced about 5 years ago, and the grizzly bear a couple years before that, and the two were compared, and it turns out that the top 17 genes that were helped the polar bear adapt to the north two-thirds of them are broken, that is, or degraded. That is, they're working less effectively there, or not at all, compared to how they work in the grizzly bear.
Like throwing the spare tire out, or the seats out, or yeah.
That's right, or throwing out, say, the governor that keeps your car under 50 miles an hour or something, so you can go faster.
Right.
Yeah, the white color of the polar bear's coat results from a gene that contributes to the production of a brown color in the grizzly bear, and when it breaks, it becomes white because there's no color left. And the most interesting thing is that there's a gene involved in fat metabolism, and the grizzly bear or the polar bear eats, seal blubber, which would be toxic for the grizzly bear. But it turns out that one of the genes involved in fat metabolism was broken, and that helped it to eat this large amount of fat.
Right.
So it turns out that the polar bear didn't evolve; it pretty much devolved from the grizzly bear.
Okay. So here's a real important question, because as I was reading through your book, Darwin Devolves, and I'm following this argument, this point, the first question I ask myself is, well, isn't that just the Darwinian mechanism of mutation and natural selection? Isn't a broken gene the same as a mutation? And so now there's this mutation that allows the polar bear to get white and to eat blubber where the grizzly couldn't. So how do you distinguish just the standard progression of mutations, which you're now calling broken genes, and the standard Darwinian model from actually a devolution model that you're advancing here based on broken gene evidence?
Well, now that we know about the molecular basis of life, we see that DNA is arranged into genes that have, informational content. They do things, and there are regulatory regions which turn genes on and off at the appropriate times, and all sorts of fancy mechanisms, and we can identify them. We can see, once we have the sequence of DNA, can see which ones do something, which other ones just kind of connect two things together. And so when we ask the question, okay, a mutation has done something beneficial, we can ask the question, well, did it do so by making a new gene or improving it or what? Or by messing it up, by breaking it. And, overwhelmingly, the data that has been collected so far shows that it's breaking stuff that was already there.
So improvements would be kind of adding a benefit. Degrading would be taking away a benefit that the gene had, though in a limited scope, it had a beneficial impact on that individual organism.
That's exactly right. And in desperate circumstances, you do desperate things. Well, it turns out in Darwinian evolution, everybody's always desperate.
Yeah.
but, you can think of a bridge, construct a bridge from one over a river from one place to another. Okay, but now suppose somebody doesn't want you to come over the bridge and they blow it up.
Mm-hmm.
That's a change, But blowing up a bridge is not the does not tell you how the bridge was constructed in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to blow up a bridge. It's much more difficult and involved to construct one.
Yeah. Well, and, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say that's what Darwinian evolution does. It mm-hmm. blows up things.
Yeah, and I think the key here, and this is what helped me when we talked last time, is that when you blow up the bridge, you can't get across the river anymore.
Yeah, you're stuck.
And so it's kind of like sending something down an evolutionary dead end. So it results like the vehicle that moves faster because it doesn't have a spare tire. It results in short-term gain. But in terms of long-term benefit, if you need that, you have a flat tire, you're out of business. Because
right.
you don't have the spare anymore. And so it's kind of like going down a dead end. I think that the way I'm thinking of it is that breaking a chain gives short-term gain, but it limits the long-term evolutionary That's, novelty or the opportunity for novelty that is required to move the entire project forward.
That's exactly right. You adapt to new circumstances, but you become more limited by doing so. Think of the polar bear again. You know, it's doing fine in the Arctic, but suppose global warming comes along and it turns into a jungle or something.
Yeah.
Its white color, which it's stuck with now, is not going to be a benefit in the jungle, and yet it's, you know, that ability was blown up and thrown away, and so it's much more likely to go extinct than to survive.
Right. Now, we just have a couple more minutes here, and because I know you have another appointment you have to get to, but I wanted to ask you very quickly, not only does mutation turn out to be a problem in the devolution sense much of the time, most of the time it seems like what you're indicating, but mm-hmm. natural selection also turns out to be a problem. Can you explain that?
Yeah, it turns out to be a problem in two senses. First of all, it grabs the first helpful change, first helpful mutation that comes along, and very often, as we were just saying, that's a degradative or destructive change.
Mm-hmm.
And once it grabs it, it spreads it through the whole population, and now nobody has a certain capability anymore, and it turns the ratchet down one more step.
Mm-hmm.
Another way in which it limits things is that it makes, once it gets its hands on something, it constricts it, it fits it more and more and more closely to the role that it's currently using,
mm-hmm.
it's currently beneficial in an organism. And that's nice, that's fine, but then it makes it much more difficult to change it to use it for some other complex process.
It's like a joke I heard the other day, a one-way street leading to a dead end.
Yeah.
You know, you can't get out. And what you're saying is natural selection just deepens the problem there by fixing it in that kind of dead-end space biologically.
Yeah, think of any specialized machine or even a mousetrap, you know. What else are you going to use a mousetrap for, you know, other complex thing? You
mm-hmm.
know, you're not going to use it as part of a radio or any such.
Right.
So it's nice to have complex machinery, but you can't, without intelligence, you can't adapt it to other things.
Yeah. So how, very briefly, last 60 seconds, how is this, your book and your material, this idea now, which is compelling, and you do a very good job of verifying your conclusions in the book, how is it being received in general? I'd imagine not well like the other work, but how is it being received, and how are people pushing back on it, or are they doing so effectively?
It's being received very well outside of scientific circles. I've gotten, you know, positive feedback from a lot of people, and I've spoken at conferences and so on. In reviews, the only reviews have been by, you know, dyed-in-the-wool Darwinists.
Yeah.
And, you know, they just hate it. But it's fascinating that they haven't, in the two most prominent reviews, they haven't offered any counter arguments.
Right.
They barely even state the argument at all. The only thing they say is Behe says that, you know, evolution only works by breaking things. But here, look, we've got this, that, and the other thing.
Mm-hmm.
They don't say what my evidence was, you know, how this
right.
affects. But they just essentially roll out the same stories of, you know, some noble gene duplicating and turning into something else
yeah.
without even considering how these degradatory processes would affect it. So I'm you know, it's kind of good and bad in that mm-hmm. it's good because nobody has laid a finger on the argument.
Yeah.
It's great. And it's bad, though, because they show the same signs of, you know, just sticking their heads in the sand
resistance,
as before.
Right. Uh-huh. Well, the book is Darwin Devolves, The New Science About DNA That Challenges Evolution, author Michael Behe, his third major work in this area. Mike, keep up the good work. I appreciate you spending some time with me today, and we're thrilled about the work and contribution you've made to the ID movement.
Well, thanks a lot for having me. It's always fun to talk to you.
Okay, thanks, Mike. Michael Behe, once again, Darwin's Black Box, The Edge of Evolution, Darwin Devolves, professor of biochemistry at Lehigh University, senior founding fellow of the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. I recommend the book. And I recommend it not just for, obviously, the new material, but I had so much fun, if that's the right way to put it, with the review of the old stuff. And I'll tell you, for me, what I took to the bank was this notion of pretense of knowledge, because I have I've been frustrated so much with the habit of people, as I've said before, waving the wand of evolution, the presumption that everything evolved, and so all they have to do is look at some feature. And then they just say evolution has done this or that, like evolution has, what did I read here? We have evolved, humans have evolved the ability to equate sweet tastes with safety, for example, or something like that, or all the entire field of human psychology. I've read whole books on this, or human morality. And the idea that, well, we know it evolved, so there must have been some process. Evolution selected us. We've evolved the ability to believe in right and wrong, to protect us. Really? How exactly did that happen? How does moving molecules around cause a belief to pop into existence? See the problem? Like I said, the devil's in the details. Just remember that. Anytime somebody says, well, that evolved, you can ask somebody, how precisely did that happen? Has someone demonstrated that particular thing has evolved in that way? Well, that's it for this hour, friends. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. I'm Greg Kolkel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven. Bye-bye now.